This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is the city's largest union of municipal employees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. This is our first show of the new year. We've been on a hiatus for the past couple of weeks. A lot to talk about. On the show this evening, it will be CUNY CUNY history professor and labor historian Joshua B. Friedman. We'll be talking about, now, as we're recording this, it is Thursday. There will be a new president, a new inauguration on Friday. There will be a huge march on Washington on Saturday. And as you're hearing this, it all happened already. So, but we're going to talk about what it all means in terms of the 45th president of the United States and what it means for labor and the labor movement. I am privileged to be the editor of the Public Employee Press, and the most recent issue, the December-January issue, which should have arrived in DC 37 members' mailboxes just around the holidays, we did a piece on highlights of 2016. And while 2017 promises to be a very challenging time, I wanted to remind you of some of the things that were accomplished last year. Despite the anti-union rhetoric and attacks going on across the country, DC 37 made significant strides by recruiting new activists while strengthening its workplace presence, deepening ties to the community, and developing more political clout. Among the highlights, well, we had an insourcing victory where we're working with the city administration to reduce the city's employment of consultants and bring the work back in-house. The city has so far hired several hundred information technology workers. The union expects the city to hire up to 1,000 IT workers in the near future. We also worked with the four local unions that represent library workers. We have guaranteed the long-term fiscal health of the city. We helped to guarantee the long-term fiscal health of the city's public libraries. During the year's budget process, the union pushed for the city council to agree to baseline funding, which is establishes a floor for the city's annual allocation of funds to the three library systems. We protected the fiscal health of members' pensions by, DC 37 Executive Director Henry Garrido sits on the board of the New York City Employees Retirement System, worked with other trustees to dump the $1.4 billion investment in hedge funds, which have high administrative fees but have had low yields in recent years. Just three of the accomplishments from 2016. DC 37 members can read all about the highlights of 2016 in the December-January issue of the PEP. And if you want to, we're trying to be as interactive as possible on this show. If you have any comments, any suggestions, anything you hear on this show that you want to respond to, State of the Union at dc37.net is the email address. Drop us your response to anything that you hear on this show. If you have a suggestion about the show, State of the Union at dc37.net, and we will read all the responses that we can on air. Please keep your responses not too long. And also, no profanity will be allowed. This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show. We'll be right back with CUNY professor Josh Friedman.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today, 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. District Council 37 is the city's largest union of municipal employees. Joining us now in the studio is labor historian and CUNY history professor Josh Friedman. Good evening, sir.
Very nice to be here.
Unless there was an act of God, we're recording on Thursday. Friday was the inauguration. Saturday there was a big women's march across the country. There were marches and protests. Donald Trump is the 45th president of the United States. We wanted to talk a little bit about what this means, specifically from the perspective of labor and from the perspective of the country. How divided are we? I think there are some factors that make it seem that like we're very divided. Social media is one of them. I think that, and I just wanted to get your take before we even start talking about the labor, about the state of the country now in terms of, this was a very contentious election. 3 million more voters voted for, nearly 3 million voted for Hillary Clinton than Donald Trump. There seems to be cultural divides, geographic divides, ethnic divides. How, from a perspective of U.S. history, how divided are we?
Well, there's certainly moments in U.S. history we've been more divided. You know, the most obvious example would be the Civil War. But even past that, for example, in the late 19th century, the United States was really deeply divided by political and economic divisions. Tremendous turmoil, protest involving labor and many other groups, way beyond anything we've seen recently. And, of course, racial divides were much deeper and much uglier through most of the history of the United States than they are today. So, we're not at the equivalent of the most divided moments yet. I think when you're looking at the post-World War II period, the more recent period, this is one of the more sharply divided moments, you know, and I think, as you said, you know, it's cultural, it's political, and in my view, it also is economic. That underlying all this is the combination of the stagnation of living standards for most Americans and then this, you know, hyper-rich group, you know, which more and more dominates our life. And, you know, this plays out in all kinds of complicated ways. It doesn't lead to a simple divide, but I think it's the impulse, both in the United States and many other places too, for a kind of new, intense, conflictual politics.
And the role of social media in all this, I mean, I remember as a kid, I remember the Civil Rights Movement, I remember the night Martin Luther King got shot, I remember the night Bobby Kennedy got shot. But there was... We all watched those horrible events through like three TV networks, and we were never really that. I never really had a sense as a kid in Queens of what the rest of the world, the rest of the country, was thinking, saying, doing. And I've thought this before. If in fact there had been social media when Martin Luther King got killed, you would no doubt see a great deal of ugliness that you didn't really know about because we were much more insulated than we are now. Do you agree with any of that or not so much?
I mean, I see your point. I think there's something to it. On the other hand, you know, newspapers were more robust.
Right.
You know, New York had lots of newspapers. They had more in those newspapers. There was a lot of local coverage. So, you know, I think there was a more – there was an era, and it's relatively short, basically the 20th century, when because of radio and television, there was a kind of national common channel for receiving information. But both before and now, again, you know, I think it's a more fragmented universe of information. I find it very hard to translate this into what its political effects are. I mean,
right.
You know, we hear a lot about it, and I'm not discounting this idea, but I think it's there's no simple equation in my view.
Well, as an academic, what do you think about this fake news phenomenon, this idea that people are getting that once upon a time we disagreed about the issues around a set of facts, but there seems to be some difference of opinion now as to what the facts are at any given time.
Well, that's not new. Americans had different worldviews. I mean, I guess the famous example of this would be the Scopes trial about evolution. And, you know, one part of America just took for granted a certain set of ideas that come out of a biblical account of the history of the world. Others came from scientific. So the idea that different facts were taken for granted, you know, it's not completely new. I think what I find so distressing maybe as a teacher is how much baseline information people just don't have. You know, it's after this election, people are going, now what's that electoral college thing? I see it in my own students, the old-fashioned civics education. How is a bill passed? You know, right. What does government do? What does the Constitution say? I think that kind of knowledge is very low. And it's a problem.
I woke up to something on social media this morning where I think Jimmy Kimmel was asking folks about the Affordable Care Act. Mm. And during the course of these interviews, it became clear that most people had no idea that the Affordable Care Act was Obamacare, that we now have this – now there's another wave of thought of that – Obama is responsible for ending the Affordable Care Act,
right.
Which isn't true at all. But these right. are the kinds of facts that you think everybody knows
right.
at this stage of the game.
No, I think that's absolutely a big problem, you know, in terms of the very low level of engagement in education. Yeah, there's also a lot of people distrusting facts coming from the so-called authorities because the so-called authorities often put forth a set of facts that, you know, support their position or their way of understanding the world. And what exactly is a fact, you know, becomes, you know, the free market's the best system. That's a fact,
right.
You know, and that's taught as a fact. And, you know, a lot of people are going, hey, it's not helping me, you know. So the skepticism of fact, you know, we can't simply blame it on, you know, those stupid people. You know, a lot of it is the powerful folks who put forth a set of facts and people's life experience show they aren't true. So then everything's up for grabs and you get in a kind of crazy situation. And with so little baseline knowledge, then fake news seems plausible, you know.
We're talking with CUNY history professor and labor historian Josh Freeman. This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE. I'm Chris Policano. What are the challenges confronting the labor movement in 2017?
Well, you know, the labor movement's had a lot of challenges for quite a long time. But with our new president, I think there are a number of different things that could happen. First of all, on the administrative level, the new administration can by itself make very, very important changes, you know, through the Department of Labor and through the NLRB. All kinds of rules regulating overtime, who can organize, procurement rules, rules about how discrimination is handled. Many of these can be changed unilaterally by the administration. So that can happen quickly now if, you know, the Trump administration decides to go that route. We now also have a Republican Congress and a Republican president. You know, Congress could next week, if it wants, change the National Labor Relations Act. Congress could say the union shop is illegal in the United States.
A national right to work law.
Yeah, exactly, for the private sector. And the president could sign it, and that's that. Now, Trump is not listed this on his agenda, and we haven't seen this yet coming out of Congress, But something like that could. Bacon Davis, you know, which sets construction worker wages in federally funded construction projects. Yeah, who knows? Congress could eliminate that, you know, say, oh, we want to do infrastructure and make it cheaper. So those are big threats. Now, those are mostly private sector threats. I think in the public sector, I think the Supreme Court will be the big issue, and particularly a rerun of the Friedrichs case, which came up last year. And this is whether or not it's constitutional for a state to say that public employees can have either a union shop or an agency shop. New York State has a law like that. Members of your union, DC 37, work under that law. Friedrichs was a case which challenged that, that said that violated the federal constitution. Because it was a 4-4 split, the current situation remained in place.
And it was a 4-4 split because Justice Scalia had died.
He had just died just prior to that. A lot of people thought the court was poised to overthrow that. We don't know. But there will be a new justice, I assume, you know, fairly soon. Conceivably, if there's a new justice appointed this spring, a case could come before the court next fall. And within not much more than a year from now, there could be a new decision. And that could, for example, say union shop or agency shop is unconstitutional. That would be a big, big, big challenge, even in a place like New York City, which is so heavily unionized.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because one, as you say, New York City is heavily unionized, but a Supreme Court decision is the law of the land, right? So, or interprets the law of the land. So no matter what people's beliefs or intentions are in a certain locality, such as New York City, you still have to abide by this law that is anti-union in a very anti-union town, in a very unionized, even in a very unionized town.
Yes, that's right. And normally public sector law, labor law, is, you know, local and basically state law. But here's a situation where the Supreme Court might say, well, yes, it's a state law, but the problem is that state law violates the federal constitution. So you can't have that state law. And that would affect every state, you know, both places with very few unions or places where public employee unionism is banned, which is, you know, big chunks of the country, but also places like New York and California and Illinois with high union density. Absolutely. And, you know, this would mean, you know, no doubt membership loss for unions. How big? We don't know. And revenue loss, you know. So this would be a big challenge. I know a number of the unions, when Friedrichs was coming down the line, DC 37 particularly, you know, tried to anticipate this, take steps to prepare. But, you know, we may go through this all over again. It's hard to
think. And there are definitely cases coming up. I mean, Friedrichs has been decided. There are other cases, other suits. I read something yesterday that there is a suit that has been filed in Utica, New York. And there is an organized group, the National Right to Work folks, who are bringing these cases up just to do exactly what we're talking about, which is to change the law. And you obviously don't share any pathological optimism that Donald Trump would be appointing Barack Obama Supreme Court.
I don't think he's going to be appointing Barack Obama. On the other hand,
yes.
I think that everyone should be prepared for an adverse court decision, but you never know. And in fact, even with Friedrichs, I was one of the people that said, you know, just wait to see the actual decision. We don't know. We don't even know who the ninth justice of the Supreme Court might be, you know, 3 months from now. So it's not a done deal, but it's certainly a possibility. I think, at least in the legal institutional sense, that's the biggest threat to the public sector.
Do you have any sense, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you have any sense of Trump's labor history? I mean, there was a very contentious situation in Nevada. I recently with one of his hotels, to unionize one of his hotels, and we were out. AFSCME was out joining our union brothers and sisters on the picket line in some very awful heat, but we were out there. But the past on Trump, I mean, there are horror stories, I believe, about, you know, foreign workers and subjecting them to adverse working conditions and the like. But I'm doing the talking. Tell me.
I'm no great expert on it, but you know, I think it's a mixed record. You know, he comes out of the New York State real estate industry, and like a lot of, in fact, like most developers, you know, he, you know, on fairly sizable projects, he's just union labor. So, you know, he is not ideologically, you know, dead set against the idea of unionized labor, and he's not inexperienced in dealing with unionized labor. It is certainly true, though, for example, in the hotels, he resisted the effort by Unite Here to organize. On the other hand, you know, when he got elected, he wanted this to go away, and he made it go away by giving a pretty good deal to those workers. So I think the most unpredictable thing for labor in the coming year is our new president. I think he could go lots of different ways. You know, he's not beholden to the traditional powers that be. He's not really an ideologue. He is allied with a million anti-union forces, but, you know, I don't think he's necessarily going to go that route. You could imagine like a kind of Nixonian effort to build an alliance with parts of the labor movement behind, let's say, infrastructure and other kinds of programs. You could imagine the opposite, you know, him going right after unions and trying to bust them up. He's a very unpredictable fella.
Some say that's his strength. Others say he is a sort of has a moral vacuum where there is no ideology behind any of his decisions, and that as a result of that, there's a certain maybe amorality that does not. It's very hard to get your hands around someone when you don't really know what he believes in.
Right.
And he still remains as much of a mystery, even after one of the longest, most arduous, crazy campaigns in our time. Do you share some optimism about that, that that's a good thing, that he is a practical, could be a practical president?
I optimism is probably too strong. I think there are, you know, there's some things that he has been consistent. He's been consistent critic of free trade, and he's been consistent about controlling the borders and building a wall. And I think we will see something happen on those two issues. I think he has to do that. Beyond that, I agree with you. He's very little that seems to be core beliefs. He's a kind of buccaneer, a narcissist,
right.
And that can go all sorts of ways. And he's certainly shaken up the establishment. I can imagine a feud between him and the Republican Party, and a very nasty one. But I can imagine just the opposite. He steps back, lets the conservative Republicans, you know, the Ryans and the, you know, and that crew run America, and he tweets. So, you know, it could go lots of ways. I think we're just too early in it to really know where it's going to go.
Let's talk about New York City labor. You pointed out that DC 37, thank you very much, did a great deal of organizing to fend off Friedrichs and made sure that, you know, the members know what we're doing, much more outreach to the members. This show is an example of that, more regular production of this show, talking to the members, trying to get input from. What about the state of labor in New York in general? Are there examples that you can point to of innovation in terms of labor thinking differently about its role?
Well, I think it's primarily in the private sector we've seen that. You know, after a fight for 15, in many ways started here in New York, the idea that you could improve the lives of low-wage workers and not do it through traditional union organizing, but through demonstrations, through political pressure, you know, which has proved quite effective. And I think that's been a real it's not just New York, but, you know, Washington State and California. But that's been a very innovative, really, effort. And I think the effort to work with workers' centers and immigrant groups and build a more capacious labor movement, one that's not a labor movement, oh, that means you're a union member, but it's working people in varieties. So I think we've seen some of that. And I think that's quite a positive thing. On the other hand, I often wonder whether we're in a kind of fool's paradise, you know, particularly in the public sector. We've never really faced a real anti-union crusade. And, you know, the private sector is...
Here in New York.
Here in New York.
Right. Okay.
And the private sector in New York is pretty weak at this point. It's better than other places, but, you know, you're talking about, I don't know, what is it, 17%, 18%, something like that. they're not a great defense shield if the next mayor, whoever that might be, decides to go after the public sector, particularly maybe with a different legal framework now. I don't know how well prepared the New York City unions are to make their case to a New York City taxpayer that doesn't have a pension as good as a public employee, you know, doesn't have health care like I have and you have as public employees and so forth. So I don't know. I worry sometimes that we're not.
I have to say that when the biggest boon to this whole effort, what I thought was going to be the changing point, was Occupy Wall Street and the raising of the issue of income inequality. And that instead of saying, oh, pointing fingers and blaming someone for having a pension, the question would become, why don't we have our pensions anymore?
Right.
It is frustrating, to as things have turned out, to see that that finger pointing still exists, because there had been some progress. And now with this new election and the Republican Congress and Republican governors all over the place, this issue of income inequality seemed to be something that we could grab onto and, you know, make the strongest case possible. It's not the way, it hasn't worked out the way we wanted it to in terms of this blame game about how well should working people be allowed to live.
No, I agree with you, but I'm going to be a rare optimist here.
Okay,
because sometimes things play out in ways that you can't anticipate. There is no way that Governor Andrew Cuomo would have supported what's effectively now going to be free tuition at the State University and the City University of New York if it hadn't been for Occupy. Now, Occupy and Andrew Cuomo at that point were complete loggerheads. He was defending, you know, pro-business policies. He was making fun of a higher minimum wage. Oh, the legislature's not. And here we are a few years later. And, you know, for whatever reason, I'm glad he's made this switch. You know, he is pushing, you know, things like high minimum wage,
free tuition,
effectively free tuition, and a number of other very progressive programs. So Occupy itself doesn't exist anymore, you know, and I agree with you that some of the arguments about inequality have kind of either faded or gone in a bad direction. But there have been long-lasting gains in indirect ways that I think have stemmed from that. And I think it also had a good effect on the labor movement, you know, which opened up its eyes both about tactics, but more importantly about issues, you know, about how to frame issues. So I agree with you. It was a monumental moment that we will benefit from for a long time to come.
We've been talking to CUNY history professor and labor historian Josh Friedman. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 FM. Josh, thank you very much for this conversation. Very helpful in terms of there are so many folks out there going, and we are two of them. What is next?
Yeah.
What is next? A couple of announcements to make before we take our leave for this week. DC 37 begins its month-long celebration of Black history with a ribbon-cutting ceremony Wednesday, February 1st. The grand finale takes place on Tuesday, February 28th. Both of these events are at 6 p.m. at Union Headquarters. For more information about all Black History celebrations during Black History Month, call 212-815-1113. If you want to learn more about purchasing your first home or refinancing, come to DC 37's Municipal Employees Housing Program Housing Seminar, Friday, February 17th at 5:30 p.m. at Union Headquarters. To pre-register, call 212-815-1814. That's all the time we have for this segment of State of the Union. Till next time, ciao.